secret book of all the religions. And what will happen then?
Yes.
You know, if you, for example, if you are strong enough and powerful enough to fight against, for example, a religion, so you have to criticize that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to show the weakness and the poor, for example, let's say, teachings and doctrines of that religion to the people. And you have to,
yes,
for example, reason against that.
Yes.
By reasoning, by, let's say, rational kind of argumentations, you can show what is true, what is false,
mm-hmm,
by logic. And there's no need to burn, for example, a book. If you burn thousands of books, never, what will happen is nothing for you.
Yes.
You know, you achieve nothing, particularly nowadays.
Yes.
That every thing is available on this modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you, for example, burn a book, then millions of people search that book and they in the internet and they find that and they read that.
Yes.
So, you know, it will have
so what
no,
do you
nothing
think
for you.
The main reasons are, I mean, isn't it because of the misbehavior of some of the radical Muslims all across the world? For example, committing suicide bombing or attacking here and there, especially by ISIS, you know, and these extremists, have made a kind of harsh and violent picture of the Muslims in the minds of the Westerners. So some of them, which do not have enough knowledge about the religion of Islam, and we cannot accuse the others that say, okay, go and study about Islam and search and this and that. Usually the public and the illiterate do not have such a knowledge, so they go and burn it.
You know, we should know that sometimes we have bad people or evil people among, for example, Christians, among Jews, among Buddhists, among Hindus, among Muslims. But we should separate the, for example, true religion of Islam from those people. Look, for example, Hindus in India, sometimes there are some radical, let's say, extremist Hindus who sometimes,
yes,
for example, kill Buddhists, who kill Muslims. Should we say that it is Hinduism,
mm-hmm,
totally that do such a thing against, for example, non-Hindus? Or there are sometimes Hindus and Buddhists in some of the Eastern Asian countries, like Rohingya, for example,
yes,
were killed by these people. So can we say that it is all the Buddhist people across the globe who are like that? Or, for example, there are sometimes radical Christians, radical Jews who do something against, for example, other people, other nations. Can we say that it is, can we blame it on the religion, on Judaism, on Christianity, on Hinduism and Buddhism? Of course not. So that's why, first of all, we should understand that the mainstream Muslim scholars, Muslim nation in the history, they respect it. They lived peacefully with non-Muslims. What we see in the history.
Yes.
So if in modern time, particularly in the 20th century, if we see sometimes there are some very extremist and let's say radical kind of group by the name of Islam who do something and it is propagated worldwide,
yes,
by the mass media, which is controlled by the Western powers,
yes,
at least this question should come to our mind that, okay, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
We, Islam is a religion that we've had it for 14 centuries, more, mm-hmm, than 1,000 years, you know? So what happened now is totally opposed to what we have in the history. So now is it a new version of Islam? Is it something new? Is it something invented by, for example, a specific group of Muslims? So if that is the case, then it should not be blamed on Islam as a religion, that it is Islam, which, for example, we have such thing in Islam. So that's why there might be a kind of misunderstanding, misconception,
yes,
of Islam, which is mostly caused by mass media in the West. You know, they,
yes,
deliberately and actually purposefully, we can say, propagate against Islam, and they highlight this kind of misbehavior of some specific groups by the name of Islam.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praises to Allah, all glories to Allah. We worship Allah and no one but Allah.
in the present Sweden, in Norway, in Denmark, you know, even in Denmark, for example, if you could remember, we can say Rasmus Paludan was a person who unfortunately burned the Quran, and he was burning Quran under police protection in Copenhagen, Denmark in 2019, okay? So how the police of a country is going to protect a person who is burning the Holy Quran without reading the book?
Yeah,
this is a book, you know. Yeah, a book must be read, not to be burned.
Yeah. You know, something which is really ironic and very interesting is this, that they believe in freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. If you go to Denmark, for example, or Sweden,
yes,
they tell you that, yeah, we have this freedom of expression. Now, if you really believe in freedom of expression, Quran is an expression.
Yes.
You know, it is something expressed by the Islam in that book. So if you believe in freedom of expression, why do you burn an expression?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really illogical and irrational. Yes. Because if something is like an expressed thing, so if you believe, if you support, for example, freedom of expression, then how can you stop an expression? How you can ban and limit an expression? Because Quran is still an expression. It's nothing else.
Yes.
Expression. So can you, for example, can you at the same time saying that, yeah, we believe in freedom of expression, we perform it, we actually apply it in our life, but at the same time, you do not allow an expression?
Yes.
You know, isn't it like contradictory with what we see, you know?
Okay.
So that is why under the title of freedom of expression, they try to ban an expression itself.
Yes.
This is really ironic. This is really interesting that we should always take into consideration.
Interrogators at the Guantanamo, the Bay Base, you know, unfortunately, there have been so many allegations of the deliberate desecration of the Quran in front of Muslim prisoners, you know. It was a U.S. military investigation, you know. But the Quran desecrations of the personals were taking place over there. There have been so many other cases in Bangladesh. Even, we can say, in the other countries, unfortunately, they have desecrated the Quran. But as you said, the religion of Islam never invites the people and the Muslims to burn a book. Not only holy scriptures, but a book. A book is to be, as you said, read out, is to be, as you said, criticized. So if you got any criticism regarding the teachings of Islam, you have to refer to the ulama of Islam, and we have to refer to the ayahs of the Holy Quran, which is in confirmation of the previous religions too. This is a media game too, isn't it, Sheikh?
Of course, as I told you.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, if you go to among the normal people, ordinary people, you know.
Yes, yes.
Now, for example, if you go to that Stockholm, or for example, that city in which
Sweden,
Quran,
Copenhagen,
Sweden,
yes,
in Copenhagen, in Denmark, if you go in that city, look, thousands of Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, people living peacefully together.
Mm-hmm.
There's no problem. The same city, you know, the Copenhagen.
Yes.
Then, unfortunately, mass media come, and then, for example, governments come, governors, I don't know, some kind of political approaches come to these kind of issues, and they together try to just make use of it, sometimes misuse, you know? They try to just, what we can say, achieve their own interests by just burning something like Quran in that city.
That's
to just, I don't know, to unfortunately, to misuse those people or to, let's say, what you can say, motivate, for example, people against each other. You know, it is mostly, as you rightly mentioned, it's a kind of game which is played sometimes by media, sometimes by the governors, by the government's political kind of figures.
That's right.
Otherwise, for the normal people, for the ordinary people, as they live together in the history peacefully with each other, they can live till the end of the world's life peacefully with each other. That because always we have different religions, always we have different schools of thought, always we have different nations, different tribes, different people, different cultures. It is the nature of this world, you know, it is the nature of the globe.
Okay, that's all right. So many countries all across the world condemn the Quran desecration in Sweden, which took place this year during Eid al-Adha. We hope that the countries who claim to be the supporters of the freedom of speech and freedom of expression, we can say, do not replace it with the disrespectful actions against the religious beliefs and the religious values of the other countries. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. It was very kind of you.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Do not forget in your du'as and supplications on the sessions and the majalis that you attend during the holy months of Muharram, during the months of Muharram, especially on the days of Tasua and Ashura. Do not forget to visit our website too at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the 9th consecutive time, and a 10th increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table, to continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day where millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in Turkey to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein.
Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries. But now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists.
In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the Holy Book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year, mashallah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by its the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the Grand Deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, an opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. Sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang.
The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mojahedin-e Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be dispatched from the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past 4 decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has wrapped up the 11th edition of aerial drills codenamed Defenders of Velayat Sanctuary. During the 2-day nationwide maneuvers, Air Force units conducted a full range of operations and exercised various tactics using drones, fighter jets, transport, logistical, and refueling aircraft, as well as air ambulances. The operations were conducted over various areas from the Persian Gulf to the northwestern and northeastern regions. The main stage of the drills kicked off in the central province of Isfahan on Sunday night, as fighter jets and bombers carried out nocturnal operations and detonated the MEK enemy's ground targets with Qasid-upgraded standoff missiles. The Iranian military drones also conducted major operations. Various combat, reconnaissance and electronic warfare UAVs such as Kaman 12, Karar, Mohajer 6 and Arash destroyed targets using different modified bombs with pinpoint accuracy. On the sideline of the drills in Isfahan, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, hailed the Air Force for achieving the main objectives of the maneuvers, saying the country's military preparedness prevents enemies from taking any hostile action.
The Army's Air Force has provided a very suitable and acceptable level of security for Iran's airspace from the north to the Strait of Hormuz and the three islands of the Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa. With this level of readiness, no enemy has the capability to penetrate and violate the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Major General Bagheri also said the power, readiness, and vigilance of the Air Force will constantly improve, promising a brighter future ahead. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headway in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Homegrown Iranian military products have also found many clients in the world. Iranian officials have repeatedly warned that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are entirely meant for defense.
This massive exercise is aimed at bolstering preparedness of the Iranian Air Force. It also serves as a clear warning message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic against any act of aggression. Mahdi Abbasian, Anorak.
The United States Federal Reserve raised the interest rate once again, reaching its highest level in 22 years, with no indication for when it will return to normal.
We'd be comfortable cutting rates when we're comfortable cutting rates, and that won't be this year, I don't think. Inflation remains well above a longer-run goal of 2%. Growth in consumer spending appears to have slowed from earlier in the year. Although activity in the housing sector has picked up somewhat, it remains well below levels of a year ago, largely reflecting higher mortgage rates.
Low consumer spending spells major trouble for an economy in which consumer spending provides 70% of GDP. The housing sector just saw its first price decline in 6 years, and housing is the primary financial asset for the average family.
A well-known byproduct of prolonged high interest rates is that it will cause precarious businesses to go bankrupt and provoke mass unemployment. Data shows this is already taking place.
Corporate bankruptcies just hit their highest first-half levels since 2010. Planned layoffs are at the highest first-half levels since 2009. The damage done by prolonged high interest rates is revealed by the highest level in years for credit card, car loan, and other debt, and all while still failing to reduce record prices for the most basic goods.
People are suffering from it, and a lot of more people are going to food banks to get food because they can't afford to buy a lot of the food. And also the government has cut food subsidies for people who in need.
Despite the economic hardship, Washington has ended key coronavirus-era programs, with health insurance just revoked for millions of people. States are reporting their first increases in years for their poverty rates, all of which contributes to President Joe Biden's near-record-low approval rating.
Yeah, they might cause Biden to lose the election because he's not doing enough about inflation. I'm sure he knows that. I mean, people are going to, whatever, if it's going to be Trump versus Biden or whoever, people are going to vote for where the economic situation, where they think it's going to be better. Because most people see the two parties as being the same.
There are other ways to curb excessive prices that don't burden the working class, such as price controls, limiting corporate profits, preventing price gouging, and increasing wages. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A Zionist court has ordered the removal of Palestinian Negev village to build Jewish neighborhood. Residents of Ras Jaraba, which predates the fabricated regime of Israel, says that despite concerns for their future, they will fight the decision to the end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, the decision will affect 500 native people from Ras Jaraba village who have been left in a state of shock after the decision by the Be'er Sheva Magistrate Court recently. Residents of the village, which predates the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948, say the news fell on them like a thunderbolt and was difficult to process.
Musa al-Hawashle, a resident of Ras Jebrah, told Middle East Eye, "Young people have been calling me since the morning, telling me about their concerns for the future. We don't know where we will go. We have been here before the regime of Israel, and now we will be expelled from our homeland." The Ras Jebrah case began in 2019, when the Israel Land Authority, ILA, filed 10 eviction lawsuits against 127 residents of the village and their families. The government body argued that the presence of Ras Jebrah, which is unrecognized as an official village by the fabricated regime of Israel, hindered the expansion of the nearby city of Dimona. Dimona was built on land owned by the nomadic indigenous Palestinian tribe of Al-Hawashle, which also owns land in adjacent Ras Jebrah village. The fabricated regime of Israel wants to remove Ras Jebrah, an area of around 34 hectares, and replace it with a new neighborhood for Zionist citizens called Rotem, which will include thousands of housing units. Recently, a magistrate court ruled in favor of the Zionist regime and ordered the Palestinian families to leave the village they've lived in for generations, giving them a deadline of March 1, 2024. The families were also ordered to pay a sum of 117,000 shekels to cover legal expenses. Adala, the Haifa-based legal center for Arab minority rights, which is representing the Palestinian residents, said they will appeal against the decision. It argued that the court disregarded the residents' arguments in its judgment. Adala said in a statement, "Since the Nakba, the regime of Israel has employed a range of tools and policies to forcibly displace the Bedouin residents in the Naqab. Their livelihood has been confined to restricted areas and segregated townships, and they have been subjected to harsh living conditions with no regard for their basic needs and way of life. The forced displacement of Ras Jebrah residents to expand the Jewish city of Dimona, which was built on the residents' lands, serves as clear evidence that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid against its Palestinian citizens." Hawashla says that while residents will protest against the decision and fight it all the way in the courts, they have little hope in the current ultra-nationalist regime, which has placed the acceleration of Judaization of the Naqab at the heart of its guiding policy. Hawashla told Middle East Eye, "The new government is worse than the one before. They want to demolish the village to build a new neighborhood. The government has not offered alternative suggestions. It has been difficult to process and explain to the younger people. I worry about them, their future, and where they will go." According to Adala, Ras Jebrah residents suggested that their village be integrated into the newly planned part of Dimona, a request that was turned down. The village is one of around 30 unrecognized Palestinian villages in the Negev region of the Zionist regime's southern territory. Almost 100,000 Palestinians who held Israeli citizenship live in these unrecognized villages, which are denied any infrastructure or support from the regime of Israel government. There are no means of transportation, no roads, no schools, and Israeli authorities don't collaborate with their local leadership. Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories are the descendants of the native population which was violently displaced by Zionist militias during the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948. At least 300,000 Palestinians live in the Negev region and say that Israeli regime authorities have attempted to force them out and destroy their nomadic way of life for decades through various tactics. These include confiscation of lands from native Palestinians and turning landowners into tenants. Additionally, the Israeli regime government has been accused of preventing the expansion of Palestinian villages and encircling them with new Zionist Jewish settlements. Youssef Al-Atwana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli parliament with the Hadash Tal coalition, told Middle East Eye, "The goal of the Israeli government is to take control over Arab land in the Naqab and to expel entire communities from the land. This has been ongoing since 1948, and some families have been displaced twice." The MP said he's collaborating with the Negev-based committee to organize a large-scale protest over the expulsions and projects taking place. He said, "People are very angry over the racism that is taking place. But despite the difficult circumstances, fines and displacements, people are remaining steadfast and strong," he added, predicting that the recent court decision will likely inflame tensions in the Negev. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported a Palestinian citizen was wounded in the hand on July 28 after Israeli regime settlers attacked his vehicle near the village of Al-Mughayr to the east of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, local sources told Wafa. A number of Zionist settlers attacked the vehicle of a citizen from the town of Beitunia near the village of Al-Mughayr, injuring him in the hand, the sources added. The vehicle's windshield was shattered as a result of the attack, while the man was taken Al-Mughayr Medical Center for treatment. Zionist settler violence against Palestinians and their property is commonplace in the West Bank and is backed and supported by the hard-right Israeli government. There are over 700,000 Zionist settlers illegally occupying portions of the West Bank in violation of international law and established norms prohibiting the relocation of the occupying power civil population to the land of the occupied.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners you're listening to IRIB English Radio and this is your station again
yes we have the pleasure to be here at your service Youth Station so previously on Youth Station if you remember Bita and if you dear audience would remember we talked about being grateful and thankful
yeah
Now, we said we talked much of the reasons of why we tend to be ungrateful sometimes.
Yeah, and you made some excuses. Like,
yeah, and I made some excuses that are not to me
justifying
an excuse.
Yourself and so on. Yeah.
Well, to me, they're not excuses, they are reasons. But at the very same time, so the truth is that we have to be grateful because, as you just mentioned, nobody has promised us that everything is going to be eternal.
Exactly.
We come to this world with this notion that everything has an end. There's a full stop to your beautiful life story. And then all the blessings that you have are going to be taken from you. So you have to be prepared for that day, though it's very difficult. And I know how excruciating I might sound right now.
Exactly.
Well, it's even painful for me to say it.
Saying it is even painful because we're greedy human beings.
But unfortunately, isn't it the truth?
It is.
Yeah.
And the truth is always bitter.
So bitter.
Yes,
so bitter. So let's now talk more about the time when we are grateful. What would happen to me if I stop being ungrateful and start being grateful?
I think there are going to be many beautiful consequences when you tend to be grateful about everything. And one of the most important things that happens when you are grateful about everything is that you're going to stop comparing yourself to other people. You know, I think I have to elaborate it more. When you are grateful, you are counting your blessings behind being grateful. So you are seeing yourself as the way you are. Unfortunately, because all the factors like social media, like, you know, the modern world is somehow forcing us to be shameful about every part of us. You know, we're not perfect. So I'm not beautiful.
Yeah, they make you
I'm
focus
not,
on the things
exactly,
you don't have.
Yeah. Because they want money. This is their business, but this is not what you have to pursue and go through in your life. And when you are grateful about, I don't know, even your face in a mirror, besides feeling good about everything and have a nice day, you're going to feel like, okay, I don't need to compare myself to anyone, to any celebrity, to any famous people. And this is one of the biggest consequences that I've experienced in my life. You know, at first, I was really sad that I couldn't get into Tehran University. And I got the chance to apply for the second university in Tehran. And I just told myself, come on, even this place that you are in is a place that most of the people crave for. So you have to stop being ungrateful and compare yourself to the people got acceptance to that university. And this is a relief.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like, oh my gosh, a heavy burden just lifted away from your shoulders.
And the thing about it is that grateful makes you feel healthier mentally.
Yeah.
You know, let's go for a short break and then we'll talk about it. Saying that being grateful makes you look healthier mentally, considering your mind and your heart, you're gonna feel healthier. But then, you're listening to Youth Station. I'm Asma.
And I'm Beta.
This combination again is talking about being grateful and how is it going to affect your mental health.
Yeah. So I think this matter of mental health is really important nowadays. You know, we are going through these mental disorders and problems, which are more highlighted than our physical problems.
Too much of them, Beta.
Yeah,
too
exactly.
Much of them. In past, we didn't see people like suffering mentally that much.
Exactly. But
that
nowadays,
much like we have it right now. You know, in past, we saw that in our family gatherings, all the aunts, when they sit together, they could talk about, you know, even the saddest stories they said it with too much of passion.
Exactly.
And they laughed in the middle of it. And they
were feeling of sympathy.
Simply and very easily, they were laughing at their problems. But right now, when I tell you about the result of my exam and I have this pain in my heart.
Exactly.
I don't know where it comes from, but, you know, there is an unknown feeling of sadness that exist inside of us. And this does not help us and let us be, you know, be even, how to say it, be even more active.
Yeah.
About the potentials that we have. You know, sometimes I say, maybe I could have been a better person, a well-achieved person. Maybe I could have done more of things. But instead of that, I sit in a place, I thought too much, I got sad, maybe sometimes I shed tears, maybe sometimes I felt so disappointed at everything and at life, and I did nothing. Though I could have gone the other way totally. I have a problem, or even if I don't have a problem, I look at the beautiful things that are around me. Look at the life that God has given to me as a mission to my to myself, you know, to improve myself, to show myself, to achieve this person who's going to be known to Allah.
You know what? The thing that you described is something we call it a hell loop, I think. And you know, a hell loop is a feeling that, for example, you understand that you have a kind of feeling of sadness. And you are sad because if you feel like you are sad. You know? And this sadness for your sadness is going to have a strong effect on your sadness and you're going to be more sad.
Like the story of Little Prince, you know?
Yeah.
As that prince was going through different planets.
My favorite story, by the way.
In one of the planets, he met this drunk person and he asked him, "Why are you drinking?" And then he said, in order just to forget what? Yeah. Okay. He said, "Forget how embarrassed and shameful I am." So just see how paradoxical it is.
It is.
You do something to forget something that you already have created for yourself.
Exactly. And I think this is the thing that we are doing every day.
Every time, every moment. We're doing it all the time.
I think this is why we are facing these mental problems these
And too
days
much
more.
Of depression, you know?
Yeah.
Too much of depression.
And
like we don't get happy so easily.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
I think one of the, side effects of this mindset, which you're not enough, feeling not enough is depression. You know, there are many factors nowadays that we feel like we're not enough. We're not enough to be in a society. We're not enough to talk, we're not enough to work, we're not enough. And this feeling will make us not do anything, and this not doing anything
and
again.
And the other side of that, you're not enough code that you just said, is the thing that no matter how much you're going to try, you're not going to get into the highest point.
Yeah, I know.
No matter how much you're going to try.
And because of that, you're not grateful because you see nothing to be grateful
for. Exactly.
And this is the problem, I think.
And the thing is that as a healthy person, I feel like everything should go well because everyone is healthy. So it's not a value. It's not a virtue. Because see what I'm saying? I say that we just take them for granted. We think that, okay, if I'm healthy, everyone else is healthy. Now the competition is on money.
Yeah.
I don't have money. If I have money, I would think that, okay, everybody has money. I want more of that.
Yeah, exactly.
If I have more of that, I would search for something even more than that. So the greed that exists in human soul is insatiable. It's as if you're never going to get the idea and the feeling that the things are enough.
Yeah.
You know, this feeling that, okay, I'm satisfied and I feel contentment in the core of my heart, I guess is something that is so far-fetched for us that are living in this modern world.
And another thing I want to mention briefly is that sometimes you have to be grateful for the things you don't have.
Exactly.
You know what? There is this beautiful, verse in Holy Quran that sometimes you feel something is really
good
true
for
and good for you.
You long for it.
Exactly.
But it's
but this is harmful
bad
for you.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same. Sometimes you lose something. Sometimes, I don't know, you may lose your arm. But this will lead you to a new road, a new path in your life.
You know, I see many people, unfortunately, in media. And just as I read some comments, yeah. I feel so, I just feel like lost. There was this a story of a man who had this demented child.
Yeah.
And then everybody, since he was so affluent, he was so wealthy, he had cars and houses, all the lives that, all this luxurious life that everyone would long for. And then the comments down there, but he was writing that money does not bring happiness.
Yeah.
Money would never buy prosperity for you and peace. And then the people down there were writing that, okay, we wish that we had your life, even with that child. So just imagine, where are we going?
Yeah, where are we going?
Sometimes in a simple house where people do not have too much of money, where people do not have even enough of money to, you know, to get...
To have a proper food.
Yeah, to have a proper food. Still... When they gather together, they laugh, they are happy. You know, they are the shoulder for each other. They are there for each other, and they do not feel alone in this life. Those people, to me, they are even more prosperous than that guy. They're wealthier than him.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the world is changing all the concepts.
All the values.
All the values are changed.
You know, what you told just reminds me of what I read somewhere, a comment. I prefer to be a rich and sad person than be a kind of poor and happy person.
I guess if a person from 100 years ago would look at us and the things we say, those people would feel like shocked. They would think of us as crazy people.
Yeah.
Because nobody would give up on peace and happiness just because of money.
But, you know, I think the value of being enough in this time.
You know, they kill themselves to get money to go all around the world.
So
and then
what?
When they go all around the world, when they finish doing all of that, they come to understand that they're lonely. Yeah. They're so lonely and their life is empty. They are not feeling anything. So what's the use of money when my soul is poor?
Exactly.
My soul is feeling so poor. You know, time is flying and we don't have too much of time. But just to give the gist of the whole of the thing that we were talking about, being grateful is good for you. It's not a goodness that you do to your Lord. No, he does not need our thinking. He is not in need of me being grateful to him. The thing is that being grateful is going to help your soul, your mental health, and you're going to feel like more satisfied with yourself. And contentment and satisfaction with your own self is a treasure, I suppose.
It is a blessing.
Because when you have it, then you would never long for anything. You would never fight for anything trivial. Because you know that the pearl exists in the shell of your heart.
Yeah.
So you're keeping it safe in there. And then you're not going for any useless thing.
So I'm really grateful that you have me here and we have this conversation.
I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.